Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're going to be talking about Alzheimer's, dementia, and early onset Alzheimer's. Our attention was focused on early onset with the death, very sad death, recently in late June of Pat Summitt, the award-winning coach. She had received a Presidential Medal of Freedom honor given to her by President Obama just a couple years earlier. And people are worried about Alzheimer's and early onset Alzheimer's. Our guest this hour writes that a recent study asking Americans who are 60 years of age or older the condition they were most afraid of getting, and the number one fear was Alzheimer's or dementia, 35%, followed by cancer, 23%, and stroke, 15%. People worry that if you're losing your car keys or you can't remember somebody's name and you're slightly older, that it's the beginning of the signs of Alzheimer's. Is it? Is there a normal aging process and your memory isn't as great as it used to be? And what about early onset Alzheimer's? Why do people get Alzheimer's early on, and how many people may be affected because they have a genetic proclivity toward that? We'll talk about a major study that's going on about early Alzheimer's this hour as well. So I think we'll have a lot of questions because, unfortunately, too many people deal with this really devastating disease. Dr. Troy Roan is our guest. He's a biology professor at Boise State University, and his research is involved in neurodegenerative diseases, including Alzheimer's disease. His lab also has an interest in other diseases, including Parkinson's, frontal temporal dementia, Down syndrome, and vascular dementia. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Roan. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Dr. Troy Roan, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
Hello there, Kathleen. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today.
Yeah, our great pleasure. We have a lot to learn here this hour. Isn't this interesting that so many people are more afraid of Alzheimer's than they are even of cancer? Why does it worry us so?
You know, that when I saw that statistic, it really kind of surprised me as well. I just think that people are becoming more and more aware of Alzheimer's and the devastating impact it can have on families. And, you know, as people get older, I think they're right in worrying about this disease because it certainly is an age-related disorder.
Are there normal things that happen to your memory as you grow older that shouldn't concern you? And at what point do you become concerned that maybe it's not just getting older?
Absolutely. It's typical as we age that, you know, we're not going to have the same mental sharpness as we did when we're in our 20s. But, you know, I think the key is when symptoms start occurring where they really impact daily life, that's when people should be concerned. Now, the Alzheimer's Association, the National Alzheimer's Association has a great website, and they list 10 potential early symptoms and signs on their website and differentiate it from what we would consider typical age-related changes. So just to give you an example, an early sign of Alzheimer's disease might be the inability to manage a budget or to handle numbers properly. A typical age-related change may be, you know, making a small mistake balancing your checkbook or missing a monthly payment. So, you know, there are clear differences between typical age-related changes and what we see in Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm. And what about early Alzheimer's disease, early onset? Is that very rare?
It is very rare. You know, the number, the typical number that I read in the literature is anywhere between 1 and 5% of all the known cases of Alzheimer's are early onset. Most of the Alzheimer cases that we are aware of that we interact with in terms of patients are those that make up what we call late onset over the age of 65. And you know, most of the causes of late onset, we actually don't know. It certainly has something to do with getting older, but most of the cases are what we call sporadic, where we don't have a real definitive cause of why people get Alzheimer's. For early onset, which typically you're talking about, in the 40s and early 50s, genetics seems to play a much larger role. So there are rare mutations that run in families, and if you inherit one of these mutations, then you are going to get Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very rare. And, you know, but the benefit that knowledge has had is it really has helped us understand Alzheimer's disease as a whole in terms of the molecular underpinnings, and that way we can design drugs. So we've actually learned a lot from these rare cases. But, again, just to reiterate, they are rare.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about, I found of high interest, this study in Colombia, which we'll highlight in a little while, but first, let's define some things here. Do you, when you worry about Alzheimer's, are you worrying about dementia? Is dementia something different than Alzheimer's? Are they the same?
Yeah, that's a great question. I often get asked when I'm out in the community. And the best way to describe those two terms is dementia really kind of describes the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, the confusion, the memory loss, the inability to solve problems, whereas Alzheimer's disease is the leading cause of dementia. So about 70% or so of all known dementia cases are caused by Alzheimer's. So what this means, though, is that you can get dementia through other means. For example, vascular dementia is the second leading cause of dementia in the United States, and about 17 to 20% of all dementia cases are as a result of vascular dementia.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, do we know exactly what's happening in the brain that causes all of this? Is it a plaque buildup, or what is it?
Well, that's taken many years of research, and I really think it began in the early 80s and over the last 25, 30 years now. I think we have a great understanding of the what I like to call the molecular troublemakers. And there are two troublemakers, microscopic, you can't see them with the eye, they're microscopic under the microscope, that you need to have in order to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And the first are the senile plaques, as you mentioned, and the second are what we call neurofibrillary tangles, or just tangles. And we know a lot about the steps that lead to, for example, to the formation of plaques in Alzheimer's disease brain. And just like plaque on your teeth or plaque on your artery, this is literally plaque on the brain. And this material is made up of a sticky molecule called beta amyloid. And so many years of research it took to discover how this beta amyloid is formed, but now we're at the point where we have drugs and clinical trials that are targeting the ability to stop the production of beta amyloid or to help remove it from the brain.
Mm. And how are those trials going? Are they promising?
Well, Kathleen, I have to tell you, if I was to give the field of Alzheimer's disease a grade as a professor, I'd give us an F.
Really?
We have about a 94% failure rate in terms of clinical trials. I'm sure you've heard the saying, you learn more from your failures than you do your successes. And I think with each clinical trial that has not worked out, we've learned a little bit more. And I think the progress has been slow, some would say glacial, but I think we're at the point now where there's a lot of optimism in the field, and most scientists believe within the next 5 years we probably will have a drug that we call disease-modifying. That is, a drug that actually targets the plaques and or the tangles, which we don't have as of today.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good, within 5 years. Why is it that maybe we haven't, in your opinion, but it seems as though we've made a lot more progress on heart disease, that there are things that you can do to take care of yourself. We know about prevention. I'm not sure we know about that with Alzheimer's. We have cholesterol drugs. We have medicines that can be taken after you've had heart problems. Do we know more about what causes heart problems than what causes brain problems?
I think we don't understand why those people that have SPRAC Alzheimer's disease, we don't know why all of a sudden they begin to get a buildup of beta amyloid, but I do think we understand quite well the molecular steps that cause these two troublemakers to manifest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think what happened in previous clinical trials was that we weren't recruiting the right patients. In other words, many of the trials failed, in my opinion, and other scientists would probably agree with me, is that the patients were too far along in terms of their pathology and particularly their dementia. And so what if you stop beta amyloid at that point? It's like the horse is already out of the barn and you close the door, the barn doors. And I think that's kind of what we learned. The new trials that are going on right now are really targeting patients that either are asymptomatic but have a very high risk for Alzheimer's, or they're in the very mildest stages of Alzheimer's disease. And so we really believe that the drugs will work if they get into the right population. And I think that's why really the proof in the pudding will be coming out here in the near future.
I would think, and tell me if I'm wrong here, that the mild stages of Alzheimer's might be somewhat similar to the stages that we go through as we get older. So how do you make a diagnosis of Alzheimer's?
Well, again, that's one of the difficult things, is being able to, target these individuals. We don't have a good biomarker. We can't draw blood and say, aha, this person's going to get Alzheimer's. That's a big area of research right now, is trying to find a good biomarker. So most individuals are diagnosed through, after going to see a neurologist or their family physician, and most often that's when they're already showing some symptoms. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some ways that we can identify people, particularly if they carry certain genetic risk factors, or if they have a family history, or if they're showing some mild changes and they're caught early enough. But that has been an important problem, is differentiating between normal aging at the Alzheimer's disease at the very earliest stages.
And what about genetic risk factors?
So in terms of the late onset Alzheimer's disease, there are a number of genes that have been identified that if you inherit them, they don't necessarily mean you're going to get the disease, but they certainly increase your risk. And probably the most important gene, and one that I actually study in my lab, is called the APOE4 allele. And if you have this APOE4 allele, and we get one copy from mom, one copy from dad, because we have two chromosomes for each, two copies of each chromosome, it can increase your risk for Alzheimer's anywhere from 4 to 20-fold. Hmm. And it is by far the most important late onset risk factor. So for example, there's a clinical trial that's starting right now, in which people who carry this particular gene are being recruited in the clinical trial, but are not showing symptoms yet of Alzheimer's. So this is the perfect population, really, to test whether or not the drugs work, because we know that the beta amyloid builds up years or even decades before people actually get symptoms.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So we have a great therapeutic window to intervene. And so if we can identify the people that are at risk, then and test the drugs in that manner, then I think we'll really answer the question about, are we on the right path in terms of treatment?
Mm-hmm. And what about prevention? Do you believe in mind exercises?
Absolutely. There's a great famous, famous in my research arena, a study called the Nunn study. And this study was very interesting. It studied a cohort of nuns who, as you can imagine, nuns living the good life that they do. They lived in a monastery. They're very scholastic, very intellectually engaged. They didn't drink. They didn't smoke. Many of them lived into their late 90s. And what was interesting was when they examined some of these sisters post-mortem, their brains, many of them had significant levels of plaques and tangles that they should have been severely demented, but they weren't.
Hmm.
And so what came out of that study was this idea of what we call cognitive reserve, and that your brain is kind of like a muscle, and that the more you use it, the better you take care of it, the stronger it is to withstand something like Alzheimer's disease. Kathleen, the problem is you can't just all of a sudden turn 65 and say, okay, I'm going to start taking care of my brain. It doesn't work that way. These are life, you know, this is something you have to do over a lifetime or at least decades to really reap the benefits of what we call cognitive reserve. Mm. So there's a lot of belief in the field that you can do preventative things, exercise, healthy diet, engaging socially, engaging intellectually to build that cognitive reserve.
Mm. So maybe we should follow the advice of get thee to a nunnery, huh?
Absolutely.
It may be the answer.
And there's a lot of truth there. And just to give you some other, just basic things that we know, if it's bad for the heart, it's usually bad for the mind, is kind of what we say. So, things like high cholesterol, hypertension, those are risk factors for dementia as well. Diabetes is a risk factor. If you have diabetes, you increase your risk for dementia twofold. These are things that we can somewhat control, particularly type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular risk factors. And so we are strong proponents of trying to use that in terms of preventative care for Alzheimer's disease.
Interesting. Well, let's welcome phone calls. We have many calls coming in right now. We're talking about Alzheimer's. Many people fear it. We fear it. If you ask people over the age of 60, they fear it more than they fear cancer, than they fear other kinds of diseases. So what do we know about Alzheimer's and the differences between Alzheimer's and just normal aging, losing a little bit of memory? What is dementia? What are the promising clinical studies that are going on right now? And we're looking also at early onset Alzheimer's, which is more rare but more devastating for families, certainly, because it can strike people as it did with the award-winning Presidential Medal of Freedom coach, Pat Summitt, who died of early onset of Alzheimer's just in June of this year. Here's our phone number for Professor Troy Roan, Professor of Biology at Boise State University. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter, @KDunnShow. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott is our first caller for you from Oshkosh. Hi, Scott.
Good afternoon. Amazing information. Thank you, Professor, for your work. My question has to do with environmental factors, and maybe you can help solve a little dispute I was having with somebody. Environmental factors related to noise pollution and the effect of startling noises, slamming doors, screeching tires, things like that, on somebody that's showing signs of early onset Alzheimer's or just an elderly mind. Is there empirical evidence or concerns that you have about protecting somebody from these kind of things and keeping their environment quiet and stable and things like that?
Scott, thank you for that question. So if I understand you correctly, are you talking about environmental factors in terms of noise and pollution, et cetera, in terms of a cause, or someone who's diagnosed and what impact that kind of thing may have on a patient?
Well, somebody who's showing signs of early onset dementia, Alzheimer's, and then more, not so much outside noise pollution, but inside noises, TV on too loud, phones ringing too loud, things like that.
Yeah, I think that whenever we have a patient who has Alzheimer's disease, one of the things that we know is that they will have a lot of confusion. And they also can have, periods where they can become extremely scared and emotional. And so I think the environment is critical. The patient is in an environment that's safe and calm. And I would expect that a patient that's in that type of environment would benefit greatly, more so than someone who's not. But as far as empirical evidence, I really don't know. I'm not a clinician, and I don't work in an Alzheimer's care facility, so I don't know if there's any empirical evidence.
Thank you so much for your call, Scott. Sarah in West Bend, hi.
Hi, I'd like to just make a comment and also a question for the professor based on my experiences. Bringing awareness to another neurodegenerative disorder called CADASIL. I went through genetic testing 12 years ago before I was the age of 30. I knew I had a 50-50 risk for having the gene and decided I wanted to know. And I'm currently writing a book about all of my experiences, kind of a memoir and a self-help, and I'm in the process on that because I've come to learn over the last decade there's absolutely nothing on the market to help patients when their doctor is, you know, telling them or suggesting to them to go through genetic testing and how that really impacts all of your life. And I can name a lot of pros and cons but it's absolutely life-changing. But my comment to the physician is to really encourage his patients to go through a thorough financial planning process before going through genetic testing. Thankfully, I had that advice back then, and I did, and I bought extra life and long-term care and disability insurance, and I'm using those policies today, thankfully. But had I participated in a clinical research trial without having these policies, or had I gotten tested without having these policies, I would have never been able to purchase those protections later in life because it would have been on my genetic, on my medical record.
And I'm not sure I understood, Sarah. What were you tested for?
I was tested for a gene that my father had that is a neurodegenerative disorder called CADASIL.
And it's similar to Alzheimer's?
Very. A very early onset, typically starting with migraines and mood disturbances. Then my father had a stroke when he was 44.
Oh.
So it was devastating to watch him go through that, and we didn't find out until the year he passed away what the disease was that he suffered from, and then I found out I was also at risk.
Why did you want to know? How is it changing your life?
Oh, it's we need another hour.
Right.
But you know, that's I guess why I'm writing the book. It makes you live for today more. The title of my book is going to be "I Don't Buy Green Bananas Anymore." Because it truly makes you value today, makes you appreciate things. I know I have a different path today than I would have had I not known, and in many positive ways. At that time, it was extremely anxiety-provoking, and I was a nervous wreck for quite a while. And I'm doing very, very well now, and I'm very happy, but I do know this. But I'm on Facebook and things with a lot of groups, and there's just such sad, sad stories of patients where I feel like science is far ahead of medicine, that physicians order these genetic tests without properly counseling patients on the future impact of their lives and also their medical record, how it's truly impacting their financial future and financial wellness.
Mm. Well, I can hear in your voice you're doing well now, and that's great. Interesting call. Professor Rohn.
Well, I'll just comment more on the benefits of early diagnosis. For Alzheimer's disease in particular, I agree with the caller. There are a lot of benefits in terms of, you know, financially getting prepared, getting a power of attorney, getting all those affairs in order are really, really important for somebody who's just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. But I will mention for Alzheimer's disease that most of the cases, again, are not due to genetics. They're due to what we call sporadic Alzheimer's disease. You cannot be tested, and you will not know you get Alzheimer's disease until you're showing symptoms. And so it is a little bit different in terms of a pure, again, differentiating it from the much rarer, what we call early onset familial form of Alzheimer's disease.
Thank you so much for your call, Sarah. Let's go next to Sue in Spring Green. Hi, Sue.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention I had a brother who had vascular dementia, and I found one of the best things for me and my family. They have in Sauk County, it's called ADRC. It's Adults helping people, older people and things like that, and they had a class available up in Baraboo, and I went to two different days, and it was for a couple hours at a time, telling. They had a professional people up there telling people about dementia, what to expect, and even how to treat your loved one. And it was so valuable. It was so good. There were doctors there. There were nurses there. There were a lot of very well-meaning, smart people who talked to all of us, and it just made it so much easier than simple things like not being judgmental. When you talk to your loved one who is going through this, if they repeat something or they act a little funny, don't be judgmental. They don't realize that they're asking it more than once. They don't realize that they know themselves sometimes that they can't remember, but they need more love than they dare do anybody being judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
So the ADRC is a good resource for local people who are looking for some answers and wanting to help their loved ones by educating themselves.
Thank you so much for your call. And you hear from so many people who have experienced Alzheimer's in the family. This is really, really rough on family members, isn't it, Professor Rohn?
Yes, it is emotionally and financially. And Kathleen, one of the things that I wanted to mention to our audience is that, you know, women are disproportionately affected, believe it or not, by Alzheimer's disease. First of all, about two-thirds of all the caregivers taking care of people with Alzheimer's disease are women. And there's a whole slew of research now that it shows the negative impact of just being a caregiver can have on one's health and well-being. Secondly, women actually get there's a higher percentage of women who will have Alzheimer's disease and do have Alzheimer's disease than men. So this is really, I think, an important issue that we need to look at as a society, because this disease is on track to bankrupt our healthcare system. It by the middle of the century, it's going to cost $1 trillion a year to take care of at the current projections. And so the more we learn about Alzheimer's disease from all points of view, the better we're going to be able to prepare and help those people
yes.
who actually have the disease.
And do we know, Professor Rohn, why women are more disposed than men?
Well, one is they live longer. And, you know, I get asked all the time, you know, what's the one thing I can do to prevent myself from getting Alzheimer's disease? And I tell the person, don't get old, because that is the biggest risk factor, period. And the average age of women is 78 in the United States, and the average age man before the age of death is 73. And so part of it is that, for sure. It's not a large number. It's statistically different, though, that more women than men do have Alzheimer's.
Mm. Warren sends this Facebook message. Are Alzheimer's and dementia more prevalent today than in past generations? Are we more aware of it, or is it a factor in our modern world?
I think it's a combination. You know, certainly in the 50s and 60s, the crazy aunt in the basement who was senile probably had Alzheimer's disease and wasn't being diagnosed. So I think we're much better at making a diagnosis. And also people are living longer. You know, if you look at 1900, the average life expectancy was between 40 and 50 years old. And so, you know, people weren't living long enough to get Alzheimer's disease. Well, that's changed with better health care and all the things that we have now in today's society. And with that, then, we're going to see a higher number of cases of Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Sue, for your call. Maddie in Green Bay. Hi. Maddie?
Hello.
Hi, Maddie.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be 75 years old soon, and I am terrified about the prospect of getting Alzheimer's. And a couple of years ago, I heard a neurologist who deals with not Alzheimer's patients who wrote a book called Grain Brain. And anyway, his main thing was that sugar and wheat and other grains increase our likelihood of getting Alzheimer's. So I did severely cut back on those food items. Plus, I increased my blood level of vitamin D, increased probiotic, increased citric magnesium, and so there, you know, to try to help myself from keep from getting it. Also, I've read reports that Lyme disease can, if it's not properly treated and it becomes chronic, that it can cause dementia, that there are people that, in fact, that it's causing divorces even, because there are people who become verbally abusive.
All right, let's get a response. What about diet? Does that make sense? Cut down on sugar, cut down on wheat, take vitamin D?
Well, you know, I would say, again, that the link with diabetes is really clear in terms of dementia risks.
Mm-hmm.
And we also know there have been some studies looking at caloric restriction, which is, you know, a state where you reduce the number of calories, not to the point where you're malnutrition, but you significantly decrease the number of calories. And those patients, the people that were involved in the study, this was an elderly study group, their memory improved significantly. So I do think there's a lot of truth to that. We know there's an island in Okinawa, off of Japan, and these individuals, Kathleen, if you saw the diet that they eat, you just would not believe it's the most healthiest diet you've ever seen. And these people live well in their 90s, over 100, have a very low incidence of Alzheimer's disease.
Hmm. What are they eating?
Well, they, compared to the normal Japanese diet, they eat basically a third of the sugar. They don't eat any fat. They don't eat any meat.
Wow.
They eat 300% of the green and yellow vegetables. I mean, it's very healthy, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, this is not something that one can do when we turn 65 and expect that we're going to get a lot of benefit. But if you do something like this over a lifetime, then I certainly think that you're talking about a great way to prevent something like Alzheimer's disease.
Maddie mentioned...
You won't stop it. Everybody will eventually get Alzheimer's disease, but you certainly can delay it. And that's really what we're talking about from a drug perspective, too, is we don't need to cure Alzheimer's disease. If we simply delay the onset of symptoms by 3.5 years, you can cut down on the prevalence by 1/3.
Oh, that's remarkable.
Yeah.
Maddie mentioned vitamins. Do you believe in vitamins?
Well, there have been some large studies looking at vitamin E, for example, which is an antioxidant. And unfortunately, those studies were negative. So I haven't seen a lot of strong evidence to support dietary supplement as a way of preventing dementia. But you know, I'm not an expert in that area.
Okay.
So,
Maddie, thanks for your call. Gail in Fish Creek, hi.
Hi. Good conversation today. And hello, Professor. I have a question and a comment, though. A lot of the symptom behaviors that you were talking about also correlate with an issue with the parathyroid gland. And with the parathyroid gland regulating calcium, that can create calcium deposits, which will look like a plaque in the brain, and there have been lots of studies that have done that and found that to be true. And when the people get their parathyroid glands checked and the imbalance is taken care of, and they get onto a proper form of calcium, because the dolomite that they put in dairy product is not a real absorbable form of calcium, and that will have a tendency to build up. But getting a hold of the agribusiness in order to get them to change that is going to be a real challenge. So I'm wondering how shifting people's perspectives on the forms of the supplements that they take, because you do need more magnesiums and you do need vitamin K in order for your body to process properly. I think a lot more needs to be done rather than just look at another medication for Big Pharma to make money on.
Do we need more? I know that you're not an expert in this area, but would you welcome more studies on what Gail just mentioned here?
Of course. I mean, I've never heard of that link before between the parathyroid gland and Alzheimer's. You know, we're talking about a very specific pathology molecule, beta amyloid, and we know exactly how it's produced. And the drugs that are designed are targeted to stop the production of this molecule. So in my mind, the field is on the right track. We do have the right drugs in place. And again, only time will tell whether or not the drugs will be effective following clinical trials. But I'm very confident in where the field is going. In terms of vitamins and dietary supplements and things like that, you know, I come back to the bottom line, which the greatest risk factor is your age. And that's really what we know. So it's something to do with the aging process that we don't know. For the majority of cases, we're not sure of what's the cause.
Our guest, Professor Troy Roan, professor of biology at Boise State University. We're talking about Alzheimer's, dementia, early onset of Alzheimer's, and welcoming your calls at 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We want to let you know the Alzheimer's Association sends this notice on Facebook. Our page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, in case you want this information, too. Listeners across Wisconsin should know that the Alzheimer's Association provides education, care, and support services totally free of charge to individuals with dementia, their caregivers, and families. You can contact them. They have a 24/7 helpline at 800-272-3900. That's 800-272-3900, or online at alz.org/SEWI. That's online at alz.org/SEWI. It's a good service. All right, let's go back to phone calls for our guest, Professor Troy Roan, who's a professor of biology at Boise State University, and his area is on studying Alzheimer's, and he's doing a lot of lab work and is certainly on top of clinical trials that are taking place really all over the world. His research lab is involved in research concerning neurodegenerative diseases, including Alzheimer's. Also, he's working on Parkinson's, frontal temporal dementia, Down syndrome, and vascular dementia. Gina in Iowa is our next caller. Hi, Gina.
Hi.
Hi.
My sister has been diagnosed with early onset dementia. Our biggest challenge was getting any kind of healthcare professional to really look at her, do any testing. It took us a couple of years before we could get a referral to Mayo. And she has been looked into from there. We still don't have too many answers on the whole thing. But what is the cutting edge for someone who started the dementia or the Alzheimer's, is possibly at 47, 48? No clinical trials even started until age 55. So what would somebody do if we had to do it all over again? I mean, what should we have looked into?
Well, first of all, sorry to hear about your sister. There are actually the clinical trials that are ongoing right now and are recruiting patients just like your sister. So, for example, there's one trial, it's called the DIAN trial, D-I-A-N trial. And these individuals are individuals that harbor one of the genes that causes Alzheimer's, but they do not have any symptoms yet. So many of them are in their, in their late 30s, early 40s, and then they're going to be administering one of these anti-beta amyloid drugs and seeing whether or not they can delay or, stop the progression of Alzheimer's disease once it starts. So that's where we've learned our lesson. And fortunately, it's taken years for us to get to this point, but I think that's why these clinical trials are so important, the ones that are going on right now that are, some of them are still recruiting patients, is getting the right patient population. And I would encourage you to reach out to, it's called the Alzheimer's Preventative Initiative, and you can sign up for it. You can look at what clinical trials are available, and you can participate in these clinical trials. It's a great resource. Again, it's called the Alzheimer's Prevention Initiative.
Good. That's good to know about.
Google that word, and you'll be able to register. Your sister will be able to register, and who knows, we can maybe get her in a clinical trial.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. And why has it taken us so long to make any movement on figuring out what this disease is and how we can treat it? Is it just really a difficult disease for you to deal with in your laboratory?
Well, I think part of the problem, there's two issues. One is, you're talking about a brain disorder. Whenever you're talking about a brain disorder and a possible drug, many drugs have a very difficult time getting into the brain because of what's known as the blood-brain barrier. And so you may have a fantastic drug, but it can't cross the blood-brain barrier and is ineffective. Now, for those drugs that we know work, for example, in animal models of Alzheimer's disease, the problem has been that when we test them in clinical trials in humans, they have failed. And again, I think these trials are very costly and very time-consuming. And again, I think the major reason we believe is that we were not testing the right population. And so, again, I come back to the fact that that's why many of us in the field are optimistic today, is we really believe that the design of the trials is correct, that the number of trials that are going on right now have been designed properly. The drugs we know work, at least in terms of their ability to block beta amyloid. So the question will remain, the proof will come out following the phase 3 clinical trials. But we won't know that for a number of years because many of these trials have just begun.
I see. And what is this blood-brain barrier?
So it's a way that the brain protects itself from pathogens. The brain is immune compromised. And so it protects itself by the blood vessels, the capillaries, have a tight seal around them, and it's very difficult for anything to penetrate across a blood-brain barrier unless it's, for example, very lipid-soluble and has some other characteristics. And so many drugs may work great in the test tube, but then when you administer them, they actually don't cross the blood-brain barrier. So it takes years just to develop the right drug, and then, of course, it can have side effects. And so some of the clinical trials have gone awry because of toxicity. So it's a hard process to, develop the right drug that's potent, that's effective and safe, and cost effective. And I think that's what the field is experiencing right now. But I really, Kathleen, I cannot say this strongly enough. I really believe we are on the right path.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, Professor Rohn. It's good to hear something encouraging in this area. Thank you, Gina, and I hope you can get your sister into one of those trials. We go to John in Boaz. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if your professor can say a few words about CET, chronic encephalitis, where I've had 5 concussions and the last one was severe TBI. How it would relate to dementia progressing sooner than...
John, thank you. That's a great question. There's an absolute link between CTE, TBI, traumatic brain injury, and dementia. There's no question. In fact, one of my areas of research involves TBI, and one of the troublemakers that we see in Alzheimer's disease are tangles, neurofibrillary tangles, also is present in people that suffer from TBI. So there's no question any kind of brain injury can increase your risk, and the more of these brain injuries you have, the greater the risk. And so I would certainly say that those individuals that know that they've had a number of concussions, they probably are a risk for getting dementia later on.
And we go to Vicki next in Mount Horeb. Hi, Vicki.
Hello. Good afternoon. My mom is 91 and lives with us going on almost 2 years now. Her family physician from back in Iowa always said that she had more of a vascular dementia versus Alzheimer's. Is there, and I know you're not a medical doctor, but is there a medical distinction? And then also, our doctor here just put her on a drug called rivastigmine. And I just, you know, am wondering, is it worth trying? And what do we look for to know if it might be working better? Could you address either one of those issues, the difference between vascular versus Alzheimer's? And,
yeah.
You know, do
mm-hmm.
the drugs sometimes work?
So thank you, Vicki. Often you can't distinguish between vascular dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Certainly a neurologist can, but for the layperson, they present with very similar symptoms. And, in fact, there's a lot of overlap between the two disorders. Vascular dementia individuals will get plaques. They will get tangles. And people with Alzheimer's disease can also have symptoms of similar pathology as vascular dementia. So there's a lot of overlap. But in terms of the drugs, the drug that you're talking about is standard treatment. It's a drug that helps boost the levels of, one of the neurotransmitters in the brain, acetylcholine. But this is a symptomatic approach, and it's like giving an aspirin for a headache. You're not stopping the pathology, and they can provide a window of stabilization and small improvement, but shortly after 1 or 2 years, the drugs are ineffective, and of course they have lots of side effects. But that's all we have right now.
Thank you, Vicki, for your call. We have time for probably one more call. Elizabeth in Pewaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to bring up the program Music and Memory, and it was brought up through the documentary Alive Inside, which you can get off of Netflix and even your library, and it has the effect of music. You create the tailored music playlists for individuals experiencing any form of dementia, and the music comes usually from the age that they loved music from the ages from 15 to 18, and it's not just the genre of music, but specific songs. Like if they love the song, In the Mood by Glenn Miller, it can have that effect that medication sometimes cannot, and what can happen is the mood can either those that are feeling most agitated, I mean, it's a lifesaver for our caregivers, and they listen to the music, and almost as like an additional therapy, someone out of surgery has physical therapy or OT. Well, this music therapy, especially with the tailored music, can have this effect where, like I said, it can be this either those that are agitated, but also there's a video off of YouTube. It's called Henry with Alive Inside, and he's not talkative, and he is unresponsive to lots of questions, but he listens to this music and his eyes open like it's wide as a newborn that is new to life, and after that it doesn't stop there. You can ask him questions, yes or no questions, and he is alive. Like,
it is amazing what music can do for us. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. I'm sorry we're out of time, but thank you. It's another show for us. Just a reminder, too, we have this Alzheimer's Association all over Wisconsin, helpline 24/7, 800-272-3900. Dr. Troy Rome, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. I appreciate the opportunity to speak about this important disease.
Thank you. And thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production. Join us tomorrow. We're going to be talking about complementary health. We're spending a lot of money on it. That's first hour. Second hour, Harry Truman's grandson.